Firoz Mehta talks on meditation.
Meditation is defined in the dictionary as musing, as cogitating, as paying special attention to some topic or other. The dictionary also adds that this forms part of the discipline of the religia, the subject or topic being some sort of religious subject in the sense of an article of faith or a virtue or the figure of the founder of the religion or of God or something like that. Meditation in its actuality is none of these things. Meditation really is the state of supreme communion, a state in which there is no one in communion with another. The otherness has disappeared. Let us consider this state of communion at the earthly level first. In perfect marital congress, man and wife are entirely at one. How does it arise? Those who have had the blessing of knowing such marital congress are well aware that it arises spontaneously, quite naturally, when both persons are in harmony within themselves and with their environment. It is something which arises spontaneously. It is given unto the two. It is rooted in that kind of love at the human plane, which is rooted in perfect beauty, beauty of action. The action is whole and complete. It is psychophysical. Two whole living beings just naturally are in communion. And the element of any thought process or consciousness that, this is it or something like that, is absolutely out. And what is the most important aspect of it is this, that every vestige of isolated self-consciousness is completely transcended. This is the important thing to bear in mind. Such communion is so perfect that there is hardly any memory of it afterwards. For memory, which involves subsequent craving for repetition, is a scar on the mind and the heart. It emerges, it fulfills itself, and it completes itself, completely works itself out, which means, to use the Buddha's phrase, there is no substrate for another jati, usually translated as birth or rebirth, but you translate it as for another conditioned state. This kind of communion at the earthly level is wholly unconditioned. There is no thirst for sentient excitement, for pleasure. There is no demand. There is no expectation. The whole thing happens with a transcendental beauty and naturalness. This is what we must understand. Very few realize this. It is interesting to note that prince of yogis, the Yogeshwara, as he is called, Yajnavalkya, in the Brihadaranyaka, uses this as an analogy to when he talks about the state of complete communion, of perfect samadhi, of meditation. He says, as a man in the embrace of a beloved wife knows nothing inside or outside, so too the Holy One in perfect communion knows no separation, no differentiation from the total reality. Now, whereas this earthly communion may occur again and again in terms of time, space, because it belongs to the plane of samsara, this other communion, this spiritual communion of the religia, knows no cessation. It is the timeless conjugation of the self and the not self. We must use those two terms in order to talk at all about it. This timeless conjugation of the within, of which we are self-conscious in the ordinary way, and the without, of person or man and the transcendent infinite, or God, or Brahman, or whichever word you like to use. This is meditation. Now remember that the earthly analogy is a great help. When it takes place, it is not planned out, it is not thought out. One hasn't been consumed with passion, with desire from before. Midday or the evening or something, and something to be achieved and enjoyed, that's completely out. It just happens naturally, unexpected, unsought, undesired. There is no possessiveness about it. So too with this meditation. True meditation is unsought, undesired, not grasped. How do we meditate? How do we practice meditation? Why do we practice meditation? Listen to the phrase I use. Practice meditation. like you practice your scales and arpeggios in order to train your fingers to be a good pianist. No, it is not that. Creative music emerges not by training, but by divine inspiration, which is given by grace from the infinite unto the composer. And because he has the genius for it, it suddenly emerges. Wonderful, marvelous. Meditation is like that. But don't we practice meditation deliberately? And whatsoever we do with deliberation is always done with personal desire, not that divine desire, which is not my desire or your desire, but the unknown and unknowable, mysterious, creative process which manifests itself this way. We practice meditation because we desire something for self, to attain a goal, to achieve a state of calm and peace and so forth. And we predetermine, if not consciously, then unconsciously, subconsciously, we predetermine the meaning of calm and peace. Is not this a mistake? What do we know about calm and peace? We define calm and peace in terms of our limitations, our personal limitations. What may be calm and peace for me, an ordinary mortal, may be a frightful disturbance for another mortal. A person who revels in a pop group, for instance, for me would be nerve-shattering. But for him would be an extraordinary exaltation. Is not that the case? So it is not for me to define the calm and the peace of supreme communion. Consider, if that state of supreme communion emerges in you, the individual, in which you are at one moment with infinity, with totality. Totality includes every sound, every noise, every disturbance, every absence of sound, noise, or disturbance. Does totality complain of its own noise? Does totality appreciate and uphold its own absence of noise? Through the great starlit spaces, the vast infinitudes, there is silence, we say. We don't hear the music of infinitude. I say music, but it is probably the interplay of what we, at a very much lower level, call discord and concord. If totality were to reject one aspect, say discord, would transcendence be truly loving, truly upholding? You see, this we have to bear in mind. So, the element of desirously achieving or possessing the calm state, the state of communion, is a mistake. When the urge for meditation as we understand it and practice it arises. It is wise to inquire immediately, why am I wanting to meditate? Is there some deep-seated personal objective, a desire to gain something, to attain or achieve something? If there is, and it won't be difficult to discover that something like that is there, if there is, do not fight against it. Do not try to get rid of it. Observe it very carefully. Watch it with a calm mind, accepting the fact that it is there. This is part, the preliminary part of true meditation, because it will bring self-knowledge, and you will begin to understand the ways of the self. That is to say, the ways of self-consciousness, which wants to isolate itself, remain isolated, different from, separate from the total reality. It's very important to understand this process. This will be really constructive mindfulness. And this, which will not be just a meandering in thought, will enable oneself to understand just how oneself functions, what oneself really is. I imagine that I am a kind person, or that I am a very canny person, or whatever I imagine about myself. And that is all just a distorted mental construct, an image which I have raised up about myself. When we talk with another person, when we see another person, and he or she sees and talks with us, we imagine we are talking with or seeing the real being. Are we? Or is it a case of two images making gestures at each other, performing polite or perhaps not so polite antics with each other? Consider this very carefully. If I am isolatively self-conscious, then invariably and inevitably I raise up an image of you in my mind according to the impressions, according to the interpretation I have given to the impressions that have come from you to me. And my interpretation is bedeviled at the very start by my own conditioning, by my own preconceived criteria and standards and all the rest of it. My own instinctive likes or dislikes. You see how our whole mind process is a distorted, a twisted process all the way, a confused process. And therefore, I am unable to pay attention to you in the real sense. Now, we must consider for a moment this thing which we call attention. Because in meditation, what is happening is that one's whole attention, if it is the supreme state of meditation, one's whole attention has completely transcended the limitations imposed upon it by the consciousness of I as the subject attending to you or anything at all as the object. There is a separation. There is not a true communion. There are two different things. There is differentiation. There isn't the unbroken holy unity of the totality present. This is what you must carefully bear in mind. Therefore, when I communicate or try to communicate with you, true relationship can spring up only if I pay such total attention to you that all self-consciousness, all preconceived ideas, all vestiges of the influence of the memory of past experience with you is completely out. You are alive here, now. And what you are here, now, is the transformed living person from the past. Your past transforming all the time is the living now, the immediate momentary now. And that is quite different from what the past was. But we just remember the past. We store up the memory of the past in our psyche, and up it comes as a barrier between you and me. You see? So it is impossible under those circumstances to be in communion with another, in relationship with another. So you will see that if the urge for meditation arises quite spontaneously, without one desiring to meditate, without one compelling oneself to observe a routine, a set routine of time and place to meditate, then there is a chance of the living reality of meditation in its purity coming into being. You must forgive me for being so unorthodox, so heretical perhaps in some ways, maybe so shattering. But I would much rather, if it were possible for me to do so, I'm assuming the possibility, to shatter foundations of quicksand. Because that will mean security and happiness for you. Although it will be a frightening experience when it takes place. So now, having seen this, examined oneself, why do I want to meditate now? And if you see that the urge is spontaneous, natural, a perfectly simple, natural feeling. It is harmless to you, it is harmless to anyone else and to your environment. Remember the Buddha's words, he who lives not harming, not tormenting himself, not tormenting or harming others, lives with a self, becomes Brahman. He uses the Upanishadic term Brahman. Become the totality, the transcendent, all-inclusive reality. What did he mean by not harming? you and I fully understand, obviously he meant no deliberate harming with a thought or feeling of malevolence or anger or whatever it was, anything like that. That is just simple child's play, the kindergarten stage. But if I have preconceptions of you, am I not harming you by virtue of those preconceptions? Mr. John Smith applies for a job in my office. 40 years ago, he was in jail for embezzling somebody's accounts or whatever it was. And I remember that. And I say, oh yes, Mr. Smith, yes, well, can I have your application and so forth? But that memory of 40 years ago is an obstruction to my dispassionately and truly considering Mr. John Smith as well as his application. Isn't that true? So you see, all this has to be out of the situation. Let us briefly consider then how meditation proceeds with people like you and me. I'm just an ordinary person. All right. The first stage will necessarily be discursive. If I am an arahant, or something like an arahant, or like any of the great disciples of all the great teachers of the world, I could enter straight away into communion. But assuming that I can't do that, then what happens? The early stages will necessarily be discursive, granting that the first urge is simple and pure. They will be discursive. Ideas will emerge. Thoughts will come along. Past memories will rise up. The demons of hell are all inside me, just as the angels of heaven are all inside me, in this this well of the psyche, the unconscious part of it, which can contain the whole universe in it. It's a marvelous well. It's only of a very small size, but it contains everything. So the demons will arise, perhaps, and intrude. Don't fight against them. Look at them. Look at them carefully. Understand them. I am Jason, who sowed the dragon's teeth. You remember the story of the Argonauts. I sowed the dragon's teeth, and every single tooth rose up as an armed warrior and he rushes at me. Instead of fighting them, I just throw my helmet into their midst. And they fall to a fighting amongst themselves, and the whole lot sink back into the earth. You know that extraordinary teaching in Mahayana? All the deities, the peaceful ones, the wrathful ones, everything arises out of the mind, back into the mind it sinks. See, this is the sort of thing that happens. If I were to fight against these demons as they rise up inside me, then I shall be in the woeful state. But if I just look at them, knowing that the psyche can never be slain, it could be hurt, but it can never be slain. My psychical being, if I for the moment may separate psyche and body, my psychical being is indestructible as long as the organism is alive. It is quite indestructible. I only have to keep quiet. I cannot be slain. But if I had the good sense to look at all of these, be well aware of what they are, and see their true nature, I am discovering what I am at the moment. And if I truly see, then all that is transformed, be it angelic, be it demonic, it is totally transformed into what? It is resolved into the emptiness, and it is transformed into pure intelligence, which is an indescribable reality. Because of the transformation into pure intelligence, then when I see a thing as it is. When I hear the sound as it is, without my preconceptions or ideas or conflicts or beliefs or anything interfering with the seeing, the hearing, the touching. I do not get attached to it. I have no aversion for it. There is no confusion in my mind with respect to it. Now, is not this the transformative process much truer to the reality of meditation than I, in my confused, imperfect state, forcibly trying to bring about a desired, pre-pictured result? It's a very different thing. See, this is where faith and trust come in. Whether we are theists or Buddhists or whatever we are, we all talk about, oh, I trust in God, I trust in the Buddha, I trust in this, that and the other, and I do nothing of the sort whatsoever. Because the moment something comes along which frightens me or is something I don't approve of and so on, oh, well, God can go to. And I go my way. All that transcendence does is just to be utterly still and silent. And what I do is to draw impenetrable veils across my eyes and refuse the benediction of that graciousness. This is what happens. Therefore, there is no true love possible, no true wisdom possible. And one can just go round and round the rat caught in the rat trap, seeking, 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 hoping, that is, selfishly longing to possess something which we imagine is an unutterable happiness or pleasure. So be very careful about all these things. The discursive stage will quieten down if one observes in this manner, dispassionately, not attached, not averse. See? The discursive stage will quieten down. The discursive state is the surface storm. The deep, still inner waters are absolutely clear and transparent. And they are still. And that stillness will now be manifest on the surface too. And when this happens, we enter, so to say, on what, for descriptive purposes, we may call a second stage, the state of the merging, the veils, the barriers between the total reality and this person who is isolatedly self-conscious disappear. And as they disappear, and the isolative aspect of self-consciousness disappears, you experience the extraordinary power and peace and calm of the totality, of your environment, your total environment. There is a merging. The mystics of the world have written in wonderful poetic terms of this state. And this is only the beginning, this merging. You feel the at-one-ment with nature most easily. Going deeper than that, you will feel the at-one-ment with your fellow human beings easily. Fellow human beings are more difficult to be in harmony with than nature. Nature never hits back at you. Nature always has her arms open to receive you. But human beings are not quite like that. There are occasional problems and difficulties, you see. Oh, that person is Mr. So-and-so, that lady's husband, or something like that, you see, and all the rest of it. Not that one should literally do all that, but you know what I'm talking about. When this power of unselfness grows and grows, you will find that everyone around you will naturally come to you. They will naturally love you and care for you unpossessively, undemandingly, just as you love everyone and every creature unpossessively, undemandingly, expecting nothing at all. You are in that state of such complete poise inwardly that whatsoever happens through that other person, either by his own volition or not, is something which doesn't upset your equanimity. You are capable of taking it. Your psyche absorbs the other person, not constricting the other person at all, leaving the other person completely free. And in that freedom lies also your freedom. You see, what happiness could mean? Has it any relationship with pleasure and the chasing of sensational delights? None at all. From the merging, we enter into the depths. Where all sense of separation vanishes. Where the functioning and the limitations imposed by the senses is completely transcended. Which means also that the whole discursive thought process is still and calm. So when you look outside, say, and see that, it doesn't start up a train of thought or of feeling or of mere reaction, however quiet and exalted and sublime it may be, towards that. Because if a reaction starts like that, it implies the state of separateness. Does any one of us, assuming that we are well in the ordinary sense, not ill, Does any one of us react to the functioning of heart and liver and blood and so on? We don't react. It's all part of us. It's just there. There is complete peace in one's mind with respect to all that function. So too with the meditation as it deepens. Now, what is happening in connection with attentiveness? There is no isolated self-consciousness attending. There is no separate object or thing or person to which that attention is directed. There comes the stage when even this consciousness, this awareness of totality as such, that too is no longer a thing apart. You are that totality. I don't mean in size or in time and space and so on. In essential nature, this indescribable essential nature, you are one with that totality. But it is an experiencing of extraordinary reality. A reality of such a nature that any question I may ask about it is a meaningless and foolish question in the context of the infinite, the absolute. But its reality is unmistakable. It is the total absolute reality. And in that state there is the supreme communion, which is meditation, which implies, amongst other things, this perfect shunya, the emptiness of the mind. Complete emptiness of the mind, of all mental constructs, of all picture making, of all sense of separativeness, of separation, anywhere and everywhere. See, then I am in the state of the truly Holy One, the perfected Holy One. And the perfected Holy One has no mind of his own. None whatsoever. What do we mean when we say, oh, he's a man with a mind of his own? He's full of positive ideas, constructs of the mind, conceptions, and so forth, which are perhaps harder than diamond, but as opaque as a black hole in space. The light of transcendence cannot shine through such a mind. It is an obstruction. It casts a shadow. The shadow self, Monsieur le Diable. He has no mind of his own. The universal mind functions through that psychophysical organism. You will ask, what is the meaning of psyche then in this context? Of why do I say psychophysical organism? The psyche means, it stands for that receptive, responsive sensitivity which characterizes every living human being. So that the living human being is receptive to transcendent energies, to these archetypal forces which function. Therefore, one uses the term the psychophysical being. The psyche is that. And further, that psyche is specific to that particular organism. It is specific to that particular man or woman. And therefore, when universal mind functions through him, the forms in which that functioning will express itself are unique to that person. Haven't you noticed that every single great spiritual teacher has presented the truth, the one and only truth, with outstanding originality? Just consider the way in which it is presented by the teachers of the Upanishads, by Zarathustra, by Krishna, by the Buddha, by Lao Tzu, by Jesus, by Muhammad, and so on. Just consider the utter originality of the presentation. But it is our misfortune that we are so blind that we get attracted to one form of originality and then take sides with it. We express partiality for it as against another. That is a misfortune. If we enjoy the beauty of England, does that mean that we cannot enjoy the beauty of Switzerland? Or of the desert stretches of Arabia? Are the vine clusters of Judah any sweeter or more wonderful to taste than the drops of sweetness from the vale of Kashmir? I ask you, think of it yourselves. Feel it out. And as I said yesterday, this realization, which remains as a timeless conjugation, because this separated element due to avidya, ignorance, in one's own consciousness is completely out, and therefore this congress is an unending congress. It knows no limitations of time, space. It is of the nature of eternity. And it is of the nature of creation, of creative action in eternity. This is something which man hardly knows anything about. But this is the meaning of meditation, this supreme communion. This is man's destiny. Not that every man will achieve it. You see, the whole idea of achievement and so on is utterly nonsensical. It belongs to the realm of sub-man, of sub-human, not to the realm of human. Now, do not think of this as some wonderful Himalayan height which has to be climbed. The Himalaya is here now. It requires no climbing. It only requires seeing and acknowledging. Yes, the Himalaya, the everlasting, the pure white snow peaks are immaculate, perfect, and they are right within. And they remain immaculate and utterly pure. Whatsoever I do, which I tend to sully them, it is not they who get sullied, but I who become blind and deaf and dumb and so forth. And when the Holy One comes and cures me of my blindness and deafness, it is this blindness and deafness of which he heals me. So, do we begin to understand something of this inward reality of meditation, of communion? It is transcendence itself which comes to complete fruition and self, its own self-realization as man through you or me, the individual man. The phenomenon of enlightenment is manifest. The phenomenon of nirvana is manifest through that particular living psychophysical organism. It's not the attainment or the achievement of that organism. Now bear in mind that transcendence functions as the totality and the infinite totality manifests this through the finite person. The totality throws out, expresses, presses out of itself innumerable finite. And if one finite doesn't succeed in becoming the unresisting, selfless instrument for this, some other finite does. Don't think, oh, well, it's not fair not to give me a chance and give life after life. Give me a chance? What am I chattering about? Does any single cell in my body rise up and say, Firoz, for goodness sake, give me a chance? It doesn't. And if it does, well, I smile benignly and that's about all. God smiles eternally and infinitely, but he sheds bitter tears through your eyes and my eyes. Remember that. Shall I spoil the beauty of that smile, the smile of nirvana itself, the smile on the face of the Buddha? You see what meditation means? You see what communion means? And the grace of the totality is such that in our earthly experience, it gives us at least one extraordinary means of realizing something of the nature of that timeless conjugation in what conjugation we may experience in terms of time and space. Transcendence proves its immortality and its infinitude through our mortality and finitude, through meditation.